Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, November 14th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We'll start with the headline story. Memo blessing boat strikes is said to rely on Trump's claims about cartels. Accounts of a secret Justice Department memo offer a window into how administration lawyers approved the president's desired course of action. By Charlie Savage and Julian E. Barnes. A secret Justice Department memo blessing President Trump's boat strikes as lawful hangs on the idea that the United States and its allies are legally in a state of armed conflict with drug cartels, a premise that derives heavily from assertions that the White House itself has put forward, according to people who have read it. The memo from the Department's Office of Legal Counsel, which is said to be more than 40 pages long, signed off on a military campaign that has now killed 80 people in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean. It said such extrajudicial killings of people suspected of running drugs were lawful as a matter of Mr. Trump's wartime powers. In reaching that conclusion, the memo contradicts a broad range of critics who have rejected the idea that there is any armed conflict and have accused Mr. Trump of illegally ordering the military to commit murders. The administration has insisted that Mr. Trump has the authority to lawfully order the strikes under the laws of war, but it has provided scant public details about its legal analysis to buttress that conclusion. The accounts of the memo offer a window into how executive branch lawyers signed off on Mr. Trump's desired course of action, including appearing to have accepted at face value the White House's version of reality. The memo, which was completed in late summer, is said to open with a lengthy recitation of claims submitted by the White House, including that drug cartels are intentionally trying to kill Americans and destabilize the Western Hemisphere. The groups are presented not as unscrupulous businesses trying to profit from drug trafficking, but as terrorists who sell narcotics as a means of financing violence. Based on such claims, the memo states that Mr. Trump has legitimate authority to determine that the United States and its allies are legally in a formal state of armed conflict with narco-terrorist drug cartels, according to the people who have read the document. The rest of the memo's reasoning is based on that premise. For example, the people said, the memo asserts that boats believed to be carrying narcotics are lawful military targets because their cargo would otherwise generate revenue that cartels could use to buy military equipment to wage the purported armed conflict. And a lengthy section at the end of the memo, they said, offers potential legal defenses if a prosecutor were to charge administration officials or troops for involvement in the killings. Everyone in the chain of command who follows orders that comply with the laws of war has battlefield immunity, the memo says, because it is an armed conflict. The people who described the memo did so on the condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive document. Asked for comment, the White House said in a statement that Mr. Trump directed the strikes under his constitutional powers and that they complied with the law of armed conflict. Since September 2nd, the U.S. military has attacked 20 boats, either in the Caribbean Sea or the Eastern Pacific Ocean, that the administration has said were smuggling narcotics. In announcing the strikes, the administration has cited intelligence, but has not put forward specific evidence. The Trump administration has insisted that its boat strikes are lawful. In September, it told Congress that Mr. Trump had determined that the United States was in a non-international armed conflict, meaning in a war against a non-state actor, like drug cartels, and that the people it was killing aboard the boats were combatants. Outside specialists in laws governing lethal force have widely criticized that argument, and the administration has not offered a detailed public explanation of the legal analysis supporting its assertion. The omissions have included how it bridged the conceptual gap between drug trafficking and associated crimes, as serious as they are, and the kind of armed attacks that is necessary to create a state of war. The administration has, however, disclosed that an Office of Legal Counsel memorandum signed off on the operation. And while it has not made the memo public, it has started to let members of Congress and their staff read copies, while providing T. Elliot Gazer, who leads the office, to answer questions at some briefings. The memo is said to be framed around a question posed by the White House, whether limited lethal force could be used to stop vessels in international waters that are not registered to any country in order to curb the flow of narcotics from drug cartels designated as terrorist groups. In endorsing Mr. Trump's determination that there is an armed conflict, the memo accepted the White House's assertions uncritically, according to the people who have read it. For example, they said, the memo cites the White House's claim that cartels are responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans a year. But it does not address the fact that a surge in overdoses over the past decade was caused by fentanyl, which comes from labs in Mexico controlled by Mexican cartels, not by South American cocaine. The memo also cites violence by drug cartels against the security forces of other governments in the region, like Colombia's and Mexico's, and asserts that the United States can attack the cartels as a matter of collective self-defense. The people who have seen the memo said, but it does not address whether any foreign government has requested the United States to defend it by carrying out military strikes on boats in the Caribbean or Eastern Pacific Ocean. Colombia is fighting a Marxist rebel group known as the National Liberation Army, or ELN, which traffics in drugs to finance its purchases of weapons, but is not traditionally considered a drug cartel. One of the 20 strikes to date, announced on October 19th, targeted a boat that the Trump administration said was carrying a shipment linked to ELN, but Colombia's president has demanded that the United States stop striking boats, calling them murders. The memo is said to treat as significant the fact that the U.S. government has designated a range of Latin American drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. The Trump administration itself did that a few months ago at Mr. Trump's discretion. Applying that label to ordinary drug cartels and criminal gangs was unprecedented and contested, since terrorists are ideologically or religiously motivated violent groups like Al-Qaeda. By that standard, the ELN, which was designated a terrorist group in 1997, qualifies, but groups that are traditionally understood as drug cartels do not. The memo's framing of the boat strikes as a specific effort to destroy the cargoes has a different emphasis from the messaging the administration has used to justify the attacks. The strikes have been widely condemned as murders or a war crime, because even criminal suspects are considered to be civilians, and a military may not deliberately target them if they pose no immediate threat. The United States has traditionally dealt with maritime drug smuggling by intercepting boats and arresting the people on board if a search reveals illicit cargo. Responding to such criticism, Mr. Trump and members of his administration, like Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, have declared that the people crewing the boats are narco-terrorists, and the Trump administration has called them combatants. The memo, however, is said to focus instead on the purported shipments of narcotics abroad, portraying those as the specific targets of the strikes based on the theory that their sale would generate revenue that cartels would use to finance their alleged war efforts. Brian Finucane, a former State Department lawyer and specialist in the laws of war, who has been critical of the Trump administration's operation, said there was some historical practice for citing international law to justify attacks on things that an enemy uses to fund its wartime combat activities. He pointed to strikes on oil facilities run by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and on Taliban-linked drug operations in Afghanistan. But he criticized the proposition that there was an actual armed conflict with the cartels to start. Regardless, he added, he was skeptical that the specific loads of drugs being hit could meet international law standards for being legitimate military targets, arguing that their connection to any specific military activity seemed attenuated. It would be difficult to establish that the cargo on the vessels was a military objective under the law of war, because there is no obvious connection between a shipment of drugs and military action by these supposed groups, he said. By contrast, ISIS was paying actual fighters in a real armed conflict with the proceeds of its oil sales. Another part of the memo, the people said, addresses the lack of congressional authorization for the operation. The memo, they said, asserts that Mr. Trump has constitutional authority as commander-in-chief to order strikes on his own because he has determined they would be in the national interest, and because their anticipated nature, scope, and duration would fall short of a war in the constitutional sense. Despite concluding that an armed conflict is underway, the memo also says the operation is not covered by the War Powers Resolution, a 1973 law that requires presidents to terminate deployments of troops into hostilities after 60 days if Congress has not authorized them. This part of its reasoning, which has been previously reported, turns on the idea that airstrikes that do not put U.S. personnel in danger should not be interpreted as hostilities. The final section, discussing arguments that could be raised in case of any future prosecutions, is said to be lengthy, broaching, among others, the idea that U.S. personnel have immunity for killing enemy fighters in an armed conflict. Citing a need to protect society from dangerous narco-terrorist cartels, the memo compares military personnel participating in the strikes to the police who break the speed limits when pursuing a suspect who poses a threat to public safety. Those officers are not considered to have committed a crime. There have been growing signs that the campaign may escalate to land strikes. Some members of Mr. Trump's administration have pushed to remove from power Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, whom they have called the leader of a narco-terrorist cartel. The Pentagon has moved large amounts of naval-based firepower, more appropriate for major land attacks than for striking small boats, into the region, and Mr. Trump, in public, has mused about expanding on land strikes. If he does, though, the Office of Legal Counsel may need to produce another memo. The existing one does not mention Venezuela or strikes anywhere on land, the people said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Some South Korean workers return to Georgia factory after U.S. reissues visas. The State Department has reissued visas for many workers detained in a September raid, lawyers said, as the Trump administration tries to undo damage from the operation, by John Yoon. South Korean workers began returning to a factory in Georgia last month after the State Department reissued their visas, as the Trump administration seeks to undo the damage from a large workplace immigration raid. About 180 people who were in the United States on B-1 business visas have had them restored, said Kim Min-soo, who was among those detained in the raid on September 4th in southern Georgia. Two lawyers representing the workers confirmed that all the B-1 visa holders who were detained, out of 317 South Koreans detained in total, had their visas restored. At least 30 of those workers have gone back to the battery plant, which is owned by Hyundai and LG Energy Solution, said Mr. Kim, who has surveyed the South Korean ex-detainees in preparation for a class-action lawsuit against U.S. immigration authorities over their detention. His account was corroborated by screenshots and photos shared with the New York Times that show visa renewals for two of the workers. One person whose visa was revoked on September 27th had it reissued on October 22nd, the documents show. Another worker asked the U.S. Embassy in Seoul about his visa status and received an email on October 14th stating that his visa was valid. South Korea's foreign ministry said in a statement that U.S. officials had contacted the former detainees individually about their visa renewals and taken steps to ensure that no adverse information related to the Georgia operation remained on their records. In response to questions about the workers, the State Department said in a statement that it was providing visas to support South Korean investments in the United States and to allow short-term entry for people with special skills. The department said it would not comment on individual cases, citing confidentiality laws. The HLGA battery operation, which owns the plant where the raid happened, said it resumed construction activity and thanked the U.S. and South Korean governments for supporting a smooth and timely return, according to Mary Beth Kennedy, a spokeswoman. The Trump administration has sought to distance itself from the raid, which came amid its nationwide crackdown on immigration. President Lee Jae-myung of South Korea, where the raid stirred up public anger, said it was a violation of the workers' rights and would discourage companies from investing in the United States. The timing was especially awkward for Mr. Lee, who had just met President Trump at the White House and pledged to invest $350 billion in the United States in return for lower tariffs on South Korean exports. U.S. authorities detained a total of 475 workers in the raid and sent them to a detention facility that was described as unsanitary. Homeland Security officials called it the largest detention of immigrants at a U.S. workplace ever and accused them of being in the country illegally or working unlawfully. But more than half of the South Koreans detained were in the United States on valid visas, according to their lawyers, who have accused the U.S. authorities of rights abuses. Mr. Trump initially defended the raid, but then backed away from it as it became clear that the workers had skills that few Americans had. He told his government to consider letting them stay, help finish the factory, and train new workers. In October, he said he was very much opposed to the raid. "They had people from South Korea that made batteries all their lives," he said in an interview on Fox News that aired Tuesday, in which he argued that the United States needed foreign talent. "Making batteries is very complicated," he added. "It's not an easy thing and very dangerous." The South Korean workers who had been detained flew home on September 12th after the two countries negotiated their departure. U.S. officials agreed to allow the workers to return later, but many workers said they did not want to go back to the United States. The raid brought construction to a halt at the factory for some time, though Hyundai said the plant was still on track to open in the first half of 2026. In October, South Korea's foreign ministry said that the United States had agreed to allow people to work at industrial sites on B-1 short-term business visas or on a visa waiver program called the Electronic System for Travel Authorization, or ESTA, which permits certain business activities. Detainees who were on the ESTA visa waiver program were encouraged to apply for B-1 status, Mr. Kim said. Many of the non-South Korean workers came from Latin America and had other immigration statuses, including work authorization, said Julia Solorzano, the legal and policy director of the Centro de los Derechos del Migrante, an immigration rights group investigating the raid. Last week, the South Korean consulate in Atlanta held a meeting with representatives from companies that have workers in Georgia. Consulate officials told the group that B-1 visas would now permit workers to install, service, and repair overseas-purchased equipment in the United States, but not to earn income there. Those guidelines were an effort to address concerns raised by many leaders after the raid that the scope of business activity allowed with a B-1 visa, which is for temporary business travel, was unclear. The consulate also warned that workers entering the United States should carry all required documents and be prepared to answer questions from immigration officials. The detainees who have returned to Georgia are subcontractors or freelancers, as opposed to employees at LG Energy Solution, one of the companies building the battery plant along with Hyundai, said Mr. Kim, 34, an engineer who works for a subcontractor. Mr. Kim, a project manager who held a B-1 visa when he was detained, said that he had no immediate plans to return to Georgia for business. If told to go back, he said, he would not be thrilled. "It seems like the B-1 issue has been resolved, but I wouldn't be happy to return to the United States," he said. "If I were detained again, I would think twice about staying in this industry." Katie Wilson, a political newcomer, is elected mayor in Seattle. Ms. Wilson, a self-described socialist, joined the race after Mayor Bruce Harrell opposed taxing high-income residents to finance construction of new housing. By Anna Griffin. Katie Wilson, a community organizer and first-time candidate who pushed for higher taxes on the wealthy, will be Seattle's next mayor, unseating the incumbent, Bruce Harrell, who conceded on Thursday following one of the tightest elections in the city's history. Ms. Wilson's election is a Pacific Coast victory for progressive Democrats that matches Zohran Mamdani's rise in New York. "I wished her well," Mr. Harrell said after speaking to the victor. "It was a very delightful conversation. I feel very good about the future of this country and the city still. That is the attitude we have to have." Ms. Wilson is a co-founder of the Transit Riders Union, an advocacy group behind a number of local measures to expand transit access, increase renter protections, and add housing through new and higher taxes on the rich. She had never sought public office before this year and was prompted to enter Seattle's mayoral race after the incumbent, Bruce Harrell, became the public face of an effort to block a new tax on high earners to pay for housing construction. Ms. Wilson, 43, is a Pacific Northwest avatar of the generational and ideological shifts rocking the Democratic Party. She lives with her husband and 2-year-old daughter in a rented 600-square-foot apartment, does not own a car, and presented herself to voters as a champion of people, particularly Millennial and Generation Z voters, who expect to spend their lives struggling to do as well as their parents did. Partially, what we are seeing is just the impact of big tech money in our city, said Eddie Lynn, an assistant city attorney who won a seat on the Seattle City Council last week on a platform focused on liberal solutions to a lack of affordability. We are growing so fast, certain people are getting paid very well, but that wealth is not making its way to the rest of the community. Voters in Washington State cast their ballots by mail, not in person, and ballots that are returned earlier are counted before those that are cast at the last minute. Early counts in the race showed Mr. Harrell ahead comfortably, but as the counting progressed, Ms. Wilson caught up and overtook him. Historically, younger and more progressive voters have tended to vote and have their ballots counted later in the process. By Thursday afternoon, she had a lead of 2,018 votes out of 276,240 cast, a large enough margin to avoid a mandatory machine recount under state election law. The turnout was high for a mayoral election in Seattle, with 55% of eligible voters casting a ballot. Mr. Harrell, 67, has spent 2 decades in civic life in Seattle, but has now become the 5th straight mayor of the city to either not seek re-election or be defeated by a challenger. He ran as a moderate who promised to uphold basic Democratic Party values and show compassion toward people living on the streets. 8 candidates for mayor competed in a single primary in August, and the top 2 vote-getters, Ms. Wilson and Mr. Harrell, both Democrats, advanced to the general election. After he ran 9 points behind Ms. Wilson in the primary, Mr. Harrell shifted his campaign message to focus on Ms. Wilson's lack of experience running a large organization, a message that resonated enough to narrow the race between them. But with Ms. Wilson painting Mr. Harrell as a tool of the establishment, the usual perks of incumbency, deep-pocketed donors, a lengthy list of endorsements, and broad name recognition, appeared to have worked against the mayor. The central issue of the campaign was the high price of housing in Seattle, a topic that came up repeatedly in debates, forums, and interviews. Ms. Wilson will enter office with a city council that appears primed to help her address the affordability question. Progressive challengers also unseated the incumbent city council president and the city attorney in the election and won 2 other seats in the city council. Will people trust voting by phone? Alaska is going to find out. Anchorage will experiment with internet voting in local elections, betting that its ease and security will win over voters, even in an era of election conspiracy theories. By Nick Corisanti. The largest city in Alaska is about to undertake an experiment that feels both inevitable and impossibly futuristic in an era of pervasive mistrust toward elections, allowing all voters to cast ballots from their smartphones. Anchorage, home to about 240,000 registered voters, is starting small. Mail and in-person voting will still exist, but voters will also be able to open a link on their phones to cast a ballot in municipal races in April, when 6 city assembly seats and 2 school board seats are up for election. The change will not apply to higher profile races later in the year for state legislature, governor, and federal offices. But even at the local level, the trial run of phone voting, one of the first of its scale in the nation, could offer a blueprint for expanded use in future elections beyond Alaska. The cautious technological step forward is designed to help offset Alaska's logistical challenges: harsh winter, long drives to vote in rural areas, a transient population, and for Anchorage itself, a large military base nearby. Lots of ballots never get delivered, and plenty more arrive too late to be counted. Local election officials hope that the phone experiment will make it easier to vote, while also keeping their elections secure. We have a high transient population. Military, oil and gas, fishing, tourism, our people are always on the move, said Liz Edwards, the election administrator in Anchorage. And so we've been trying to make it even easier for them to vote and make it so you don't really have an excuse not to vote anymore. Through its election vendor, Democracy Live, Anchorage will use technology built by the Mobile Voting Project, a new nonprofit open source program funded by Bradley Tusk, a venture capitalist and one-time advisor to former Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg of New York City. Citing an analysis by the New York Times that found that roughly 90% of congressional and state legislative elections were effectively decided in low turnout primary races, Mr. Tusk has argued that mobile voting could be the secret to unlocking higher turnout in less advertised elections, so much so that he wrote a book on it. Primary turnout is typically 10 to 15%, and those are the extremes or different special interests, and they dictate who gets elected and what they do once they're in office, Mr. Tusk said in an interview. And that's why we either have totally dysfunctional government like D.C. or totally one-sided government. Neither of those things are in any way good, nor do they reflect where we are. But his push for phone voting comes at a time of shaken trust in elections amid the unending fallout of the 2020 election. President Trump and his allies continue to falsely claim that his loss that year was rigged, using social media to spread falsehoods about mail ballots, voting machines, and other parts of the electoral process. Right-wing election activists have clamored for paper-only elections, and election officials from both parties note that paper cannot be hacked. Even if an all-digital system can be kept secure, which is far from a guarantee, some experts worry that the political environment is too volatile to even experiment with internet voting. I can't imagine a worse time in American history to be rolling it out, said David Becker, the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, a nonpartisan group that advises election officials. He noted that many conspiracy theories about mail voting persist even though the literal paper trail makes them easily refutable. Voting digitally, he argued, could ignite new baseless doubts. Imagine what it would be like if we made the conspiracy theorists' job that much easier, Mr. Becker said. They can just say the votes got changed inside the machine. Mr. Tusk, however, believes that it is even more risky if low turnout elections keep making the nation more polarized. I don't see us being in one country in 20 years if we don't do something very different, he said. Still in its infancy, internet voting is used only sporadically around the world. Estonia, which pioneered the method 20 years ago, is the only country that allows all citizens to vote online for national and local elections, albeit primarily on a computer. While the rate of turnout in Estonia's national elections isn't exponentially higher than that of the United States, Estonians vote in greater numbers per capita in local elections than Americans do. Lukas Ilves, a former undersecretary for digital transformation in Estonia, praised the security of online elections for two reasons. They are, in fact, difficult to hack, and it's nearly impossible to do so unnoticed. The real question becomes, can you compromise the integrity of the process? And in particular, can you compromise it in such a way that the monitoring you've got in place won't detect it, and that you actually therefore materially change the outcome of the vote? Mr. Ilves said. I'll give you the punchline, which is unsurprising, which is no. To build trust and enhance security, Mr. Tusk's team will make its software system open source, publishing the code on a public forum for anyone to inspect and try to hack, hoping that such input will improve the program. The program, available only on smartphones and not on laptop or desktop computers for security reasons, will also be free for other municipalities and states to use. Security experts say that while nothing on the internet can be completely impenetrable from hacking, advances in cloud-based technology, as well as linking mobile voting to a paper backup system, could help alleviate some of the concerns. The system in Anchorage will include such a paper ballot backup. When a voter submits a vote via the platform, an election official will review their identification and then print out the vote on a ballot. The clerk's office will then tabulate those paper ballots, not the digital votes. Before the act of phone voting, the application process also requires identification approval by an election official. Voters are then sent unique links. Both Anchorage and Juneau, the capital of Alaska, recently ran much smaller experiments with phone voting. In Juneau, roughly 60 of the city's 28,000 registered voters received access to the mobile voting portal for a municipal election last month. About 30 returned ballots. Andy Hirsch, the deputy municipal clerk in Juneau, said that while the platform worked seamlessly, many parts of her district still lack good broadband access and high-speed cellular networks, which could limit the voting method's use. The way I view it is that it is a great option for people who need it, but it won't be replacing the primary way we vote for a very long time, Ms. Hirsch said. Internet voting has also long been utilized for military and overseas voters in many places across the country. Josh Ziegelbaum, the clerk in Adams County, Colorado, has used a version of internet voting for its military and overseas voters since about 2010. He is eagerly watching the Anchorage experiment. Remote voting has been done since the Civil War, Mr. Ziegelbaum said, referring to the various ways throughout history that military members have been able to vote. This is just leveraging technology that already exists, he added, saying that I think that it could be leveraged successfully to expand voting and alter the way that Americans vote. But, he cautioned, I think there's still a lot of work that has to be done. The current political environment, there's a lot of mistrust in elections, so it may be an uphill battle to really get this in place. Another obstacle for expanding the method to federal and state elections is that they have more certification requirements and stricter rules. But in Alaska, the reaction to the early test in Anchorage was almost universally positive, Ms. Edwards said. We actually got a lot of selfies of people on vacation saying, thank you so much for doing this, she said. Like, we're able to vote from Spain, or here's a picture of us at some cathedral. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. BBC apologizes to Trump but refuses to pay compensation. The BBC said it would not rebroadcast a misleadingly edited documentary, but added, "We strongly disagree there is a basis for a defamation claim," by Mark Landler. The BBC apologized to President Trump on Thursday for a misleadingly edited documentary about the attacks on the U.S. Capitol, but it refused to pay him any compensation. It was not clear whether this would forestall a $1 billion lawsuit that Mr. Trump's lawyer threatened to file in a Florida court. The lawyer, Alejandro Brito, demanded an apology, a retraction of the film, and damages that appropriately compensate President Trump for the harm caused. The BBC said it would not rebroadcast the documentary, Trump: A Second Chance, which originally aired in Britain in October 2024, on any of its platforms. But it added, "We strongly disagree there is a basis for a defamation claim." The decision to apologize to Mr. Trump but not pay compensation reflected both the relative weakness of the BBC's editorial position on the film and its unique status as a partly publicly funded broadcaster. The chair of the BBC's board, Samir Shah, had already apologized for the splicing of two parts of a speech Mr. Trump gave in front of the White House on January 6, 2021, hours before a crowd rampaged on Capitol Hill. Mr. Shah acknowledged that the editing did give the impression of a direct call for violent action. But there has been rising public opposition in Britain to the idea that the BBC would use funds from license fees paid by viewers to settle litigation by Mr. Trump, who has sued TV networks and newspapers in the United States. The leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, Ed Davey, said in Parliament that the president was trying to destroy our BBC. He called on Prime Minister Keir Starmer to demand that Mr. Trump withdraw the threat of a suit. Mr. Starmer, who has worked to cultivate warm ties with Mr. Trump, stopped short of that, though he said he would stand up for a strong, independent BBC. Media lawyers in Britain and the United States said the president would face high hurdles in winning a trial against the BBC. A court in Florida could rule that it is not the proper jurisdiction for the case, since it is not clear the film ever aired in the United States. In Britain, the case would be thrown out on the grounds that he had failed to file it within the statute of limitations, 12 months from the original airing. On Thursday, Mr. Trump said he was obligated to sue the BBC for the film, which he claimed had defrauded the public. His lawyers gave the BBC a deadline of this Friday to respond to their letter. "They actually changed my January 6th speech, which was a beautiful speech, which was a very calming speech, and they made it sound radical," Mr. Trump said on the Fox News program, The Ingram Angle. "And they actually changed it. What they did was rather incredible." Mr. Shah wrote to Mr. Trump personally to convey an apology for the editing, the BBC said. "The lapse in the film's editing had been highlighted in an internal report filed by an independent watchdog, Michael Prescott, which became public when the Daily Telegraph reported on it last week." On Thursday, the Telegraph reported on what it said had been a second, slightly different, case of misleading editing of the same speech by Mr. Trump on the BBC's marquee program Newsnight. The BBC said it was investigating the report. The furor over the film led to the resignations of two top BBC executives, Tim Davie, the Director General, and Deborah Turness, the Chief Executive of BBC News, and plunged the broadcaster into one of its gravest crises in decades. West Bank Mosque is burned as Israeli settler violence surges. Since the 2023 attack on Israel by Hamas, growing settler violence and Israeli attacks on Palestinian militants have thrown the West Bank into turmoil and displaced tens of thousands. By Nathan Odenheimer and Adam Rasgan. Extremist Israeli settlers burned a mosque in the occupied West Bank on Thursday, according to Palestinian officials, an attack that comes as U.S. and military officials are increasingly concerned over an escalation of settler violence in the territory. Since the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel led by the Palestinian militant group Hamas, there has been a drastic surge in settler violence, as well as an Israeli crackdown on Palestinian militants in the West Bank. The growing turmoil has displaced tens of thousands of West Bank Palestinians. "These extremist groups are destroying our lives," said Ahmad Salem, the imam of the mosque that was attacked on Thursday. "Every day we're feeling more scared." The attacks have exposed frustration within the Israeli military, with some commanders saying that they need the government to authorize harsher measures to crack down on lawbreakers. This year, the right-wing government, which includes settler leaders, curbed some of the powers that law enforcement authorities had been using to detain Israeli settlers. Lieutenant General Eilal Zamir, the Israeli military's chief of staff, issued a rare condemnation of settler violence against Palestinians this week. The Trump administration also expressed worry about the attacks. Secretary of State Marco Rubio warned on Wednesday that settler violence could complicate the fragile ceasefire in Gaza after a two-year war. "There's some concern about events in the West Bank spilling over and creating an effect that could undermine what we're doing in Gaza," he said. "We don't expect it to." The UN Humanitarian Affairs Office in Jerusalem has warned of a sharp rise in settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank, both in frequency and severity. UN data shows that 264 settler attacks in October caused casualties, property damage, or both, the highest monthly toll in nearly two decades. The mosque attack before dawn on Thursday was in the village of Deir Istia in the northern West Bank. It was believed to be empty at the time, and no one was hurt, according to Mr. Salem, the mosque's imam, and Ali Diab, an official in the Palestinian Authority, which governs parts of the West Bank. "The fire destroyed Qurans, blackened walls, and burned prayer rugs," Palestinian officials said. "The settlers sprayed graffiti cursing the Prophet Muhammad on the mosque's outer walls." "These actions are terrifying," said Firas Diab, the local official in Deir Istia. "What if people were in the mosque? We could have been dealing with a catastrophe." An Israeli military statement confirmed an arson attack on a mosque in the same area, but did not say who was behind it. The military condemned any form of violence and said it would continue to operate to safeguard security and order in the area. Military commanders have expressed frustration recently over the decision in January by Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, to stop approving administrative detention orders for Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Administrative detention, which allows the authorities to hold people without charge when they are deemed a security threat, is still permitted for Palestinians. Mr. Katz's predecessor, Yoav Gallant, issued many such orders when the military, or the Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence agency, recommended that they might prevent Jewish settlers from carrying out attacks. Several commanders overseeing Israeli operations in the West Bank recently asked the chief of staff, General Zamir, to urge the government to reinstate the use of administrative detention orders against violent settlers, according to two Israeli defense officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal army deliberations. Roughly 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank live under Israeli military rule, a system that offers them few, if any, guarantees for justice. In contrast, some 500,000 settlers in the territory enjoy the rights of other Israeli citizens. Palestinian and Israeli rights groups say the Israeli government turns a blind eye to settler attacks on Palestinians. Israeli soldiers and police officers who disperse the clashes frequently leave without detaining the assailants or arrest only Palestinians, the groups say. Relatively few of the Israeli perpetrators are ever indicted, let alone convicted, according to these groups. The military's statement on Thursday said the case of the mosque attack had been handed over to the Israeli police and the Shin Bet, which declined to comment. The police did not respond immediately to an inquiry. The graffiti that the settlers left on the mosque conveyed a message of defiance to the top commander of the Israeli military in the West Bank, Major General Avi Bluth. "We are not afraid of Avi Bluth," it said. After dozens of masked settlers attacked Palestinians and set fire to vehicles on Tuesday near the West Bank city of Nablus, General Bluth called their actions unacceptable and said the perpetrators should be dealt with firmly. "The directive to Israel Defense Forces soldiers is clear. Do not stand idly by and do everything in your power to prevent any act of nationalist crime," he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S. strike kills 4 on boat Trump says was smuggling drugs. The strike in the Caribbean brings the death toll in the Trump administration's lethal campaign to 40 since early September, by Helena Cooper and Eric Schmidt. The U.S. military on Wednesday killed another 4 people accused by the Trump administration of trafficking narcotics by sea, Pentagon officials said, in a strike that brings the known death toll in the administration's lethal campaign to 80 since early September. The officials said that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was waiting for video of the strike, the 20th known strike since President Trump authorized military action against drug cartels, before announcing it on social media. Mr. Hegseth later wrote on social media that the campaign would be called Operation Southern Spear, though he did not confirm the latest strike. Mr. Hegseth added that this mission defends our homeland, removes narco-terrorists from our hemisphere, and secures our homeland from the drugs that are killing our people. The Western Hemisphere is America's neighborhood, and we will protect it. There were no survivors, a Defense Department official said, on condition of anonymity, because the attack had not yet been announced. Wednesday's strike came a day after the Navy's largest and most advanced aircraft carrier, the Gerald R. Ford, arrived in the Caribbean after a deployment in Europe. The Ford added to the capability of the United States to strike boats thought to be carrying drugs or to hit targets on land in Venezuela, as the Trump administration weighs further military steps aimed at ousting the country's president, Nicolas Maduro. The 20th strike, first reported by CBS, took place in the Caribbean Sea, a Defense Department official said. The official said that an announcement was expected soon. Most of the strikes have hit boats in the Caribbean, though more recently they have expanded to targets in the Pacific Ocean. The arrival of the Ford and 3 missile-firing Navy destroyers adds about 5,500 military personnel to a force of 10,000 troops already in the region, roughly half ashore in Puerto Rico and half aboard 8 warships. With more than 15,000 military personnel, the U.S. buildup is the largest in the region in decades. Trump administration officials have provided little evidence for their claims that the people killed on the boats were smuggling narcotics. The officials say the boats have been in international waters. A wide range of specialists in laws governing the use of force have denounced the killings as illegal, because the U.S. military is not allowed to intentionally target civilians who pose no threat of imminent violence, even those suspected of being criminals. The administration maintains the strikes are lawful because President Trump has determined that the United States is in a formal armed conflict with drug cartels. American allies have also challenged the administration's narrative and rationale. Britain has stopped sharing intelligence with the United States about possible drug trafficking vessels in the Caribbean because it does not want to be complicit in the U.S. military strikes and believes the attacks are illegal, according to a senior Western official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss diplomatic and intelligence matters. Britain's decision marks a significant disagreement with one of America's closest allies and underscores the breadth of skepticism surrounding the administration's legal rationale for the strikes. For decades, Britain, which controls several territories in the Caribbean, has provided intelligence to the United States to help identify vessels that might be carrying drugs. U.S. Coast Guard crews could then act on that information to stop the vessels, board them, and seize any drugs and detain the crews. But soon after the first U.S. strikes in early September, Britain suspended the flow of intelligence to the Pentagon's Joint Interagency Task Force South, stationed in Key West, Florida. The task force includes representatives from several nations and works to reduce the illicit drug trade, the senior Western official said. Fake bomb threats baffle the police across Asia. The threatening emails and faxes bear the signature of a man who says he is being impersonated. The police in five nations have failed to stem them. By John Yoon. The first bomb threats bearing the name Takahiro Karasawa churned out of fax machines in Japan 13 years ago. Then they appeared in South Korea, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Singapore. But there have been no bombs. Mr. Karasawa, a Japanese lawyer, has said he has nothing to do with this. There have been arrests in connection with the threats, but they have kept coming, causing panic, evacuations, and investigations in multiple Asian countries. No one has a clue about who is sending them and why. Mr. Karasawa's name has come back under the spotlight in recent months with a spike in threats in South Korea. Several schools and malls in Seoul, the capital, were evacuated after they received faxed threats. The next month, a staff member at IU University, south of Seoul, received an email with the subject, "Everyone at IU University will die." It said bombs had been planted at 38 locations on the campus and was sent from an account named Takahiro Karasawa. "We panicked at first and immediately reported it to the police," said Lee Byung-hee, a university spokesman. "Dozens of police officers and firefighters arrived at the university. One of the officers, a bomb expert, said that there were no signs of any explosives and that another university had received a similar threat earlier that day. The authorities believe the center to be the same person who sent threatening faxes and emails since August 2023. South Korea has opened an international investigation. Its national police agency said last month that it had sought help from the Japanese authorities and Interpol. A South Korean official said the agency was also in touch with U.S. law enforcement agencies because the threats were sent through an American company that allows people to send faxes from the internet. Interpol did not respond to a request for comment. Japan's police agency said it does not comment on requests it has received from police officials in other countries. Meanwhile, there is no end in sight for Mr. Karasawa, who did not comment. He has blamed the threats on users on internet forums, who he says have targeted him because he represented victims of online harassment a decade ago. A decade after the first threats appeared in 2012, the police in Japan appear to have a breakthrough. A man in his 20s was arrested in Tokyo on charges related to threats bearing Mr. Karasawa's name that were sent to railway facilities. Then, in August 2023, the police in Tokyo arrested two men, both in their 20s, in connection with bomb threats that were faxed to a university. But the messages did not just keep coming, they also spread to South Korea and other countries in the region. Emails bearing his name targeted government offices and embassies in Singapore in August 2023, triggering lockdowns. No bombs were found, and the police in Singapore said at the time that the center was also behind similar hoaxes in South Korea. In the Philippines, the police said last year that emailed threats to government offices, schools, and railway facilities in 2023 and 24 were traced back to a single email address bearing Mr. Karasawa's name. and in Malaysia, threats were sent to a state police chief and a city council from someone claiming to be Mr. Kurosawa in February last year. Malaysia's national police said it closed the investigation after failing to identify the suspects. In South Korea, the messages bearing Mr. Kurosawa's name are among a wave of hoax threats that have caused nationwide alarm, with at least 20 locations targeted in the last 3 months. No bombs were found, and the police had little trouble tracking down the culprits. The threats under Mr. Kurosawa's name have yet to stop, though. Even if there is no actual threat, experts have said these messages cannot be dismissed as mere pranks. They paralyze public institutions, schools, and public facilities, and they result in excessive consumption of law enforcement resources, said Lee Man-young, president of the Korean Terror Studies Association. They cause tangible harm. It's quite serious. Mr. Kurosawa said he hoped his impersonators would stop. I have a deep affection for South Korea, Mr. Kurosawa said in a recent interview with SBS, a South Korean broadcaster. I hope the perpetrators are caught and receive severe criminal punishment. This scrappy soccer team has a chance at making the World Cup. The Faroe Islands, rugged green specks in the North Atlantic, are an underdog. Most of the guys on the team have day jobs. By Jeffrey Gettleman and Amelia Nierenberg. Rain dripped down the men's faces. The wind howled, raking the pitch. A mammoth storm had descended on the Faroe Islands, but the players just wiped their faces and kept going, running drill after drill under the misty floodlights. In just a few days, they will play the game of their lives for a chance to etch their tiny archipelago into soccer history. This is the Faroe Islands men's national soccer team, and it is the biggest underdog story in the qualifying stages of the World Cup. The Faroes have only 55,000 people. The climate is brutal. Most of the players are not full-time professionals, and they have never gotten this close. But the Faroes team, whose roster includes carpenters, electricians, a CEO, and a car salesman, is on a three-game winning streak and has performed shockingly well against much higher-ranked opponents. On Friday, the Faroe Islands have a do-or-die match against Croatia, an international powerhouse. If they somehow win or even draw, they will keep alive their chances of becoming one of the smallest territories to play in the World Cup. If you haven't heard of the Faroe Islands, you're not alone. They're an archipelago of 18 hilly islands between Scotland and Iceland in the North Atlantic and a self-governing part of the Kingdom of Denmark with even more autonomy than, say, Scotland's relationship to the United Kingdom. The Faroes were settled by Vikings centuries ago, and according to the team's members, that's where they got their grit. Everything we've done has been against the odds, said Aidan Klakstein, the head coach. It's been against the elements, against the wind, because, you know, this is not the perfect place to build a society. Our ancestors lost men on the seas and women in labor, the coach went on, in what was quickly turning into an off-the-field pep talk. But despite all these circumstances, we built one of the richest, safest, nicest societies in the world, the coach said. Everything we do is against the odds, and this isn't just a question of football. It's a question of a country. It's a question of a people. It's a question of, we have to, we must. It's not easy building a competitive soccer program here. The Faroes are one of Europe's soggiest places. It rains about 270 days a year. It's so windy, barely any trees grow, and the long, bushy grass has a battered look. The other day, the wind was gusting at 45 miles per hour, enough to shake cars on the road. Still, when it came time for soccer practice, everybody showed up. There's no full-size indoor soccer fields, so in the winter, when it's icy and snowy, the team can't play much. Most players have to work other jobs, and often it's hard work. A decade ago, one of the most promising young stars was crushed to death on a dock by a load of fish. With just days to go before the big Croatia match, René Shockey Jensen, a Faroese midfielder and an electrician, was on his knees drilling holes in a garage. Sometimes, he says, they play an away game in Europe, and the next day he's up on a roof in the wind and rain, stringing up wires. It's not ideal, he said, but I don't complain. Contrast that with the eating, sleeping, playing routine of most professional soccer players, many of whom are millionaires. Croatia's national team, for instance, is stocked with athletes who play in Europe's top leagues, and its captain, Luka Modric, is a living legend, considered one of the best midfielders in his generation. What's it like to step onto a field and play against someone like that? It's very cool, the first couple of seconds, said Halyer Hansen, a carpenter who is a centerpiece of the Faroes team, but out with a knee injury. But then you realize how good they are, and you just can't follow that level, and it's more frustrating than cool. The Faroese players are stars within their own little universe. Everyone on these islands seems to know one another, and when the players drop in at the bakery or the lumber shop, they are instantly spotted. Being from a small place has its advantages. Many members of the World Cup squad have been playing together since they were boys. They communicate almost instinctively and cover for each other. Their defense is especially tight. It's difficult to crack them open, said Tomislav Pacek, the spokesman for the Croatian Football Federation, speaking on the phone from Zagreb about the upcoming game. He had only praise for the team, calling it a tough, organized team that knows how to play together. Let me put it like this, Mr. Pacek concluded. The Faroe Islands aren't going to win the World Cup, but they're not going to beat themselves. The squad's success comes as conversations about independence from Denmark intensify. In harbor towns and on old sheep farms, there's a strong sense of what it means to be Faroese. They have their own language, which is close to Icelandic, their own flag, their own national dress, their own cuisine. Fermented meat is a specialty. And they are geographically much closer to Scotland and Iceland than Denmark, which is fighting to keep its realm together as President Trump eyes Greenland, the other overseas Danish territory. The half-dozen Faroese players interviewed were much more comfortable talking about corner kicks than politics, but all said they were pro-independence. FIFA, soccer's global governing body, allows the Faroes to compete under its own flag, just as it does for Palestine, Scotland, and for that matter, England. The Faroese players are fully aware that a World Cup appearance would be a major boost for their independence dreams, but they're going to need a string of miracles for that to happen, starting with the next game. Croatia considers itself a small place too, 4 million people, but it fields one of the world's best teams. They placed third in the previous World Cup and second in the one before that. Miraculously, when the Faroes faced Croatia in September, the Faroes held them to one goal and narrowly lost. But that game was played on the small magnet of a pitch in Tórshavn, the Faroes' capital, which is their forte. This time, they must travel to Croatia and take on the heavyweights at home. For them to advance, the other leading team in their group, the Czech Republic, will have to lose or draw in its next game against Gibraltar. But Gibraltar is considered one of Europe's weakest teams, and the Czechs stomped them earlier this year 4-0. Even if the Faroes team wins and the Czechs lose, the Faroes will still need to pull off more upsets in an additional knockout stage to get a place in the Cup, which will be held next summer in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. The players know there's a rough road ahead, but the coach's message is simple. We have a small chance, he said, but we have a chance. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, November 14th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.